Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about file descriptors with example of pipe and read and write, and emphasizing that read, when we have something like a pipe or keyboard, it gives us what's available now, waits for something to be available, but we don't have this guarantee that we get everything all the time. It depends on exactly when things end up running. Then we moved into talking about choosing when to run processes and talking about the idea of a thread being the sort of part of a process that represents something that runs on a CPU. And we said that we didn't have to have one thread per process, we can have multiple threads per process. The thread has the registers, the program counter, and a stack. And the process has the open files, contents of memory, process ID, and so on. And we have a multi-threaded process. We have multiple copies of those registers and program counters and multiple stacks, all sharing one set of open files, one heap, and set of global variables, and process ID, and so on. We went on to look at how the XV6 scheduler works, first focusing on not the sort of interesting part of how do we decide what to run, but mostly the mechanics. And XV6 has this organizational choice where they have a separate scheduler thread. So we have a thread with its own registers and stack that handles scheduling. And when you want to switch to another process in XV6, switch to another thread, you first switch to the scheduler thread. The scheduler thread runs for a little bit and then switches to the actual thing we want to run. That runs for a while and then decides to switch back, decides from something like an exception, like a timer interrupt, and then the scheduler thread runs a little bit of time again and then switches to something else. And we observed that the way the scheduler thread made its decision was the simplest possible thing. It just takes the next thing on the list of processes that can run. We also mentioned that the scheduler needed to do this little dance with locking, where we need to have some way, and we'll talk about the details of how this mechanism works, but we need to prevent us from looking at the state of a thread, like is a thread running or not, while that state was changing. And we also needed to make sure we didn't change the state of a thread, like whether it was running or not, while something else, like a system call, was looking at it. So we had this locking with acquire and release calls that was around all of our entries into the scheduler thread and switching away from it in order to make sure we didn't have any of those conflicts. When we talk about threads, we'll talk about what was that acquire and release function actually doing. But I'm mentioning it mainly because we're going to have a scheduler assignment and you need to follow the same convention, and we'll talk about why that works later on. So any questions about any of this stuff I talked about last time before we start moving on to policy questions? Yeah?
I guess what decides how many threads a process will need to run in order to complete?
So the question is, when we have these multi-threaded processes, how do we decide how many threads there are? And our general procedure from an operating system point of view is the process is going to make some system call to tell us how many threads it wants. And if it doesn't, we probably give it just one. Other questions? Okay. So at the end of last time, I started talking about sort of scheduling goals, and I used some imprecise terminology. And I'd like to be kind of precise about how we talk about what schedulers do and don't do. So I'm going to use the term goal to mean some sort of properties you want to satisfy. Like, I want that is interesting. So, for example, I want my scheduler to make it so that my web browser is fast for me. Like, that's sort of a property I want. When I click on something in the web browser, it takes effect quickly. That's something I want my scheduler to do. A policy is like what choices the scheduler makes to do that. And the mechanism is like those details we saw with XV6 about how do we switch to the scheduler, how does it maintain the information it needs to do that, and all those details. Okay, and we had this question of like, well, we have this list of runnable programs. Xv6 just chooses the first thing it finds, just iterating through the list. And we wanted to know, well, what's the best answer? And we had a bunch of ideas. So we're going to look at this in detail. And we're going to use some simplifying assumptions for our discussion here. So we're going to use lots of ideas from like 1970, when the world was simpler. We're going to say we have one program per user. So we're just going to say how good things are for a program is how good things are for one of the users of our system. And we'll imagine we have multiple users, because this was the sort of context these things were developed in. So that's what we're going to have one thread per program. So our decision of what thread to schedule is the same as what program to schedule. And we're going to assume the programs are independent. So it's not going to matter if, so what I how I schedule one program, the only way that's going to affect another program is by because I'm not scheduling the other program. I don't have to worry about I need to wait for one program to run to get the input to the next program. Even though we know from our shell that that's not really how things work. Like we run two programs that one sending output to the other. We're going to ignore that. And given these assumptions, we want to like say, what's the best answer? And to do that, we want to have these goals. We want to have some way of measuring how good are we at scheduling. So we're going to have some things we can actually measure with numbers. And we're going to call these metrics. And one of them is going to be turnaround time, also known as response time. So we mentioned we have two textbooks we refer to. They use different terms for different things. That's just how things work. People have not agreed on what exactly the terms are. So turnaround time means, so from when a program becomes runnable to when it actually finishes doing what it wants to do, how long does it take? So an example is I press a key, and now my shell is ready to receive that key press. How long is it until it's done processing that key press from the time I press a key? So this is known as turnaround time, from when things are able to run, when we could potentially start doing something, to when it finishes. So that's turnaround time, sometimes also known as response time. We also have throughput. So throughput is just how much do we get done? So if I want to like compute a billion additions, how long does that take me? And the concern here is what we'll call overhead, wasted useless work. And the biggest example we've seen for useless work is context switching, that all the time I spend doing context switching, we're saving some registers and restoring others, is time I'm not actually doing useful computations. And if I'm switching a lot between programs, that means I'm going to end up running slower overall than I need to. If I do more switching, it's going to take me more time. There might be some other sources of overhead, but we're mainly going to be concerned about context switch overhead. So another metric, and this one doesn't really have a number. So like response turnaround time, like we can like that's just a number of milliseconds, right, for each program. Throughput is an amount of operations per unit time, like or like a percentage of time we're doing useful work. Like that's like a throughput measure. We have this other one of fairness. And fairness, there are ways of defining it. There are lots of them. But the intuitive notion of fairness is that if I have three people running different programs, they get the same stuff. Where, as we'll see, like same is actually, unless it's exactly the same, it's kind of hard to say which is better than the other. And we'll see some examples of that in a bit. So first, questions on these sort of high-level three metrics. Yeah. So response time is something we'll call wait time. That's also called wait time. I'll have that on the next slide. Thanks. Other questions? Okay, so let's first talk about this turnaround time. And there's something else called wait time, which is what Arpeggi de Sue calls response time. So I'm going to try to use the terms turnaround time and wait time, because our two textbooks use response time to mean different ones of them, depending which book you're reading. So turnaround time is like, so here I have a program represented in green, and I press a key at this point in time while it's waiting for input, and it becomes ready to run. So any time after that, the operating system could start running the program on the CPU. In this example, it doesn't do that right away. It only starts running it after a little bit of time passes. And then it doesn't let it finish what it's doing. It instead switches away for a little bit before it actually finishes and starts waiting for input again. So in this example, our turnaround time is the time from when it was ready to run to when it finished doing what it was doing and was ready to do its next piece of I/O. And we call this sort of piece of green work here, we'll call this a CPU burst. So, turns out I prepared the wrong slide deck. So let's talk about what that means. So we have this period of time, after we get some input, we need to process the input and then start waiting again. And this is going to be our model for what programs do. So I am going to switch to the slide deck I thought I had. So we have that CPU burst, which I'll just show. Nope. Okay. So we have a CPU burst, and our idea is that we want to schedule those CPU bursts. So, that explains a lot. I see. Okay. No wonder. Okay. So the idea of having good response time is that when something is ready to run, we want to run it quickly. We want to minimize that wait time, and I promise I will show something really soon. Turnaround and wait time. So if we're thinking about this, we're scheduling what we call CPU bursts. So the turnaround time is the time to start the next I/O, and that's what we're going to be concerned about. And one way of thinking about this is we want to fully utilize the I/O device. So if it's a human, we want the human to have the fastest experience that they spend the least time waiting for us. If it's the network that we're talking to, we want the network to spend the least time waiting for us. But we can consider this in other contexts, if we think of scheduling a batch program on a cluster, we have the turnaround time is like how long does the user have to wait. And sort of our model of a program, when we're thinking about it this way, is that the program sort of has this alternating CPU and I/O. So like we start a read, we wait for I/O, we start a read, you know, waiting for key press and so on. And this is our model of what programs do. So one question we might have is like, how realistic is this? So people have tried to measure, like, if we think of programs in this way, like, how long are the CPU bursts? You know, is that something that makes sense? And we'll see that, you know, we can measure that empirically. And we'll get back to that in a bit. But this is our model is like this, that we have this alternating CPU and I/O, and we're basically measuring how well do we schedule each of these green sections? How efficiently do we run that when we're thinking about turnaround time or response time? So we also have throughput. And throughput is about how much useful work we get done. So if you have two programs and we switch between them, the switch takes some amount of time. Here, I'm saying it takes half a unit of time. And that's something which is not throughput. We'll also have some other considerations for losing throughput, like, well, we have caches in our processors. And when we switch to a new process, that's the cache is not going to be as efficient. So we consider that a loss of throughput. We might consider not starting I/O to like a disk as early as possible, a loss of throughput, and so on. Like that, we just get less work done overall. Then we have fairness. So fairness is often easy. So here, you know, if we have one program per user, which schedule is fairer? Is it who thinks it's the top one? The second one? So easy. There's some other cases which are trickier. So actually, a formal definition of what fair means is harder to say. So like, for example, one question you might have is like, does it matter that A runs before B here? Is that more or less fair? Have to do that. Okay. So questions about this? So now that we have these metrics, we're going to look at, with these metrics, some simple example scheduling algorithms, the two most trivial ones I can think of. That's first come, first served, and round robin. And to keep things simple, we're going to assume that we're scheduling these, again, these little bursts of CPU, and two programs become ready at almost the same time. Or alternately, they become ready while the previous program was running, but we'll mostly ignore that. And we're going to assume they become ready in some order, because first come, first serve, we need to know what came first. And for round robin, where it turns out we're going to also need an order. And one way you can think about this is that in the obvious implementations of this, our ready queue, our list of processes that are runnable, is just a linked list with some order. And we add things to it at the end as they come in. So let's look at first come, first served. So first come, first served, we just run a program until we can't. And we take the first program, hence first come, first served, and run it until it can't run anymore. So let's say we have three programs, process A, B, and C. A needs 24 units of CPU time, B needs 4, C needs 3. One way of thinking about this is A is like a CPU-bound program. It wants a lot of CPU. And B and C are probably doing a lot of I/O. So they just do a little bit of computation, and then they're waiting for like someone to press a key or something to come in on the network or something like that. So here's the schedule that first come, first serve will do. We'll run A. Then we'll run B, then we'll run C. There's also going to be some time spent context switching, which I'm just not going to show here and assume is zero for now. So we can measure the waiting time. That's the time spent while runnable. So we assume these all were runnable at time zero, and that's when they became ready. In that case, A waited for 0 units of time, B waited for 24, and C waited for 28, and that's the amount of time they spent not running up until they finished. Or we can look at the turnaround times, that A became runnable at time 0, finished at time 24, so its turnaround time is 24. B became ready at time 0, finished at time 28, so its turnaround time was 28, and so on. And typically, we're going to, and for right now, we're going to look at the mean waiting and turnaround time to evaluate how good our schedule is for this metric. And I've hopefully computed the means correctly, so you don't have to. So we also can think of what happens if instead of A arriving first, A arrived last. So we have B arrived, and C arrived, and A arrived. They just became ready at slightly different times, like slightly different, you know, different orders for like their I/O operation to complete. So in that case, we have a very different result. So the waiting time for A is 7 because it has to wait for B and C to finish. The waiting time for B is 0 because it runs first, immediately after it's ready at time 0. And the waiting time for C is 4 because it runs after it waits for B to finish. And similarly for the turnaround times. So this is, looks like a lot better schedule. So first come, first served has this property where we have this big variation and how good the schedule is, depending on what order things came in. That whatever comes first gets this big advantage, and that dramatically affects how well things work. And a name for this is the convoy effect, is that you can think of that everyone waits behind the big long thing in the schedule. So if A comes first, everyone's waiting behind A. And that causes things to be really inefficient from the standpoint of waiting time or turnaround time. Okay, so questions about, you see here? Okay, so we also have round robin. So round robin, unlike first come, first served, is going to be preemptive. So what does preemptive mean? So preemptive means we stop thread that can still run. So in the preemptive schedule, we're going to stop a thread even though it could still run for a while. In the first come, first serve, once we started running something, we didn't stop it. We just let it finish whatever it needed to do until it could no longer use the CPU. Here, we're not going to do that. We're going to say we're going to run it until either it can't run anymore, just like first come, first served, or if it just runs for too long, we're just going to say, nope, you're done. We'll get back to you later. So this is more complicated than first come, first served because we need some way of interrupting programs, even though they aren't like trying to like wait for a key press. So we have that in XV6. We have a timer interrupt. And we need a way of stopping a program when it's not ready to be stopped. We have that in XV6. We have this context switch where we save all its registers, even if it's like not in the middle of a system call. And it turns out this is XV6's scheduling algorithm, basically. This is what it's doing. And in round robin, like first come, first serve, we're going to take the next thing on the list. When something's done, we're going to put it at the end of the list. So that's where the round robin name comes from. So we're going to do them in order. So let's say things arrive in order A, B, C, and our time quantum is 1 unit of time. So we let something run for 1 unit of time. If it's not finished, we just say, sorry, we're going to get back to you later. So I just rapidly alternate. I do A for 1 unit, then B for 1 unit, then C for 1 unit. I keep doing that until they're done. So C is the first to finish here. So C runs for 1, 2, 3 units. Remember from our original example, C had only 3 units of work to do. So after that, we don't run it again. It's done. And similarly, B runs for 4 units, and then it's done. And notice that when we don't have anything to switch to, we just keep running the same thing. So here's the waiting times. And you can see that you got still have some variation depending on what order things come in, because We have to run, choose something to run first. We're just doing it based on when they arrive. But the differences are much smaller because we're switching between all the programs. So you can think of this as being, you know, maybe less good for turnaround and wait time. Like, at least we're not trying to do something about that. But there's one scheduling metric we talked about, which this seems a lot better for, which is fairness. That there are senses in which this schedule looks a lot more fair than the first come, first serve schedule. But everyone gets a chance to run pretty evenly. Okay, so questions on this? Yes. Question is, doesn't this drastically increase overhead? Yes, it does. So I didn't show, on this picture, I'm pretending context switch has taken no time, but that's not actually true. So that means that, in fact, we're going to have some extra time for the whole thing over what we have with first come, first serve in a real scenario, because we have a lot more context switches. So in addition to the order in which things came in, we can also vary this time quantum. So here I'm saying I run things for 1 unit of time, then they're done. We could say maybe sometimes I run for 2. And that's a way of doing less switching. So when I run for 2, I run A for 2 units, then B for 2 units, then C for 2 units, then A for 2 units again, B for 2 units, and it's done because it needed only 4 units. And then C has 1 unit left, so I run C, and it finishes after 1 unit of time. I'm not going to keep running C because it can't keep running. It's done. And I'm not going to leave the CPU idle, so I'm going to switch to the only thing I can do now, which is run A. Okay, so questions about the schedule? Okay. And we can do our same waiting and turnaround time computation. And we'll look later about what happens to these waiting and turnaround times, like which is better. And if you look at what we have so far, you might say, well, this is like, so this turnaround time is around 17 for our examples. And for first come, first served, it was like 27 to 14. So it doesn't seem like we have a clear winner. We're going to have sort of a better solution later on for actually doing something good about waiting and turnaround time. But for right now, it seems like round robin gives us something consistently mediocre, and first come, first served gives us something which varies all over the place. And for fairness, well, it seems like first come, first served seems really bad for fairness, and round robin seems pretty good for fairness. Okay, so that's the round robin idea. And this quantum choice makes round robin a lot more complicated than first come, first serve. We have to figure out how many time units do I want? What's the right number? And this is a trade-off. If we make that queue, that time quantum, really short, we're going to have lots of context switches. So we're going to have lower throughput. But our schedule is going to be more fair. We're going to run things the same amount, more so. If we make it really long, it actually becomes first come, first serve. Let's think of a quantum of like 1 million. That's going to be the exact same thing as first come, first served, because we're never going to have that scenario where we cut off a program before it's ready, because the program's going to have less than 1 million units of work to do. But that means we have fewer context switches. But it's unfair. We're going to favor the first program on the list a lot. And you can think of sort of first come, first serve as just a special case of round robin with an infinitely big quantum. And that we get closer and closer to that first come, first serve the more we increase the quantum. So, questions? Yeah. Okay, so something to talk about is we talked about throughput and context switches being a thing. And one question is, like, how bad are context switches anyway? So because we want to actually come up with not just like one time unit, we want to come up with a number like 10 milliseconds. Like, what is actually a good number? So a typical context switch has a cost of like 0.01 to 0.1 milliseconds. And this is tricky to measure. So this cost I'm measuring, this is not like the time from when we decide to start doing the context switch to when we're writing in the next thread. This is trying to measure the total overhead. So this includes what we call indirect costs. And the biggest one is there are things that would have been in your cache had you not had to switch away from the program and switch back. And that's part of the cost if we do like round robin switching back and forth and back and forth. That's going to be a lot of our cost, is that our caches are just going to be slower. So this is an empirical estimate from particular programs of like what the total cost was, including the cache being slower. And because it depends on things like the cache, it depends what program you have. If you have a program which never accesses memory, only does computations and registers, well, this is going to be a lot lower. If you have a program which uses all of the cache very effectively, this is going to be a lot higher. But the choice of quantum, basically you want to choose it to manage the overhead. So Linux, to give a concrete example, has chosen a quantum between about 0.75 millisecond and 6 milliseconds. And you can think of that as making this overhead be like, you know, less than 1% up to like maybe 10, 20%, depending on what we're doing. And historically, you might have seen like 1 to 100 milliseconds, but you know, the decision you're making is like, what's your percentage basically likely to be based on the quantum you choose? Okay. So questions here? Yeah.
Is the Linux time, is it like always the same, or is it dependent on the program?
The question is, does the Linux default, is it always the same on a particular system? No, that's why I have a range. So the default is this range depending on exactly what's happening. And we'll talk probably next week about what that can mean, how it would make that choice. Other questions? Yeah.
Sorry, I just want to make sure. The Linux default is for the context switching, right?
This is for how big a quantum is. Yeah, so the overhead is just an unfortunate fact of life. You can't configure it. So we want to choose the quantum to manage the overhead. So Linux has chosen this range to manage that overhead. But the overhead is just inevitable. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this picture shows you what happens for for different context switches. You know, as far as throughput and fairness, when we switch from round robin and get closer to first come, first serve, when we increase that time quantum. I haven't told you what happens to turnaround time. So what happens to turnaround time as we increase the time quantum or lower the time quantum? So let's say, here's an exercise, let's say we have no context switch overhead to worry about. So we aren't worried about that. And let's say we have round robin, we decrease the time quantum. What's it going to do to the turnaround time? I'll give you a couple minutes. You can discuss with your neighbor.
So,
To say the same option is trivial because you can only be running one program.
Oh, yeah, that is true. I didn't think of that, but yeah. So is the potential PSU would be a valid answer?
Mm-hmm. Okay, who needs more time? Or wants more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, who thinks B? People who think C? Okay, majority, who thinks D? Okay, so the answer, I believe, is C, so I have some examples. I'm just basically how to figure this out. So here's for increasing. Let's say we start out with A and B both need one unit. If we have a time quantum of 1, we run A, then we run B. And the mean turnaround time is 1.5, because A has a turnaround time of 1 unit, and B takes 2 units, because it has to wait for A to finish. If we decrease the quantum to 1/2, now A finishes after 1.5 units of time, and B finishes after 2 units of time, so our mean turnaround time is 1.75, just a little higher. Okay, so questions? Yeah. So how about decreasing the turnaround time? So here, A, I have a different set of programs to illustrate this. So here, A has a 10 units of CPUs at once, and B has 1. And if we have a time quantum of 10, B has to wait for all of A to finish. If we have a time quantum of 5, B has to wait for half of A to finish. And that decreases the mean turnaround time. And as for state of the same, we'll take our same setup as before, but let's say we started with a time quantum of 10, decreased it to 1, we have the exact same schedule, so nothing changes. So in this case, I have a time quantum of 10, but A can only run for 1 unit of time, so we only run it for 1 unit of time.
So on that first slide where you had the question, you said that to ignore the context switches, would that change these results if we had context switches included?
So the question is, would it change the results if we had context switches included? I believe the answer to this question is the same. It just makes the reasoning a lot harder, which is why I said to ignore the context switch overhead. Okay, so we mentioned about CPU and I/O burst, that this is our model of how programs work, so that we have, you know, these programs which end up going on the ready queue after doing some I/O, they go on the CPU mostly until they need to do I/O again. And a question might be, like, if we're thinking about this turnaround time notion, like, how long, you know, are those typical programs? What does that look like? And we can measure this empirically. So here's some very old measurements from 1966 of how long that time was from waiting for input to, from when they got input to when they finished, how much computation they needed to do for some real programs. And you can see this is measured in ticks of 16.7 milliseconds. And you can see this sort of peak here. And then there's a lot of outliers of things which take a long time. And what we can see empirically is that basically we have a lot of things where you type something and you quickly get a response, or you enter some input and quickly get a response. And then we have things where we're doing some long computation. And I'm going to separate these out and say, like, these are these things here, which take only like 30 milliseconds, are sort of I/O bound. They're mostly waiting for keyboard input. And these things over here are CPU bound. And this also occurs with more recent measurements. I have trouble finding things more recent than 1990, but here's measurements for 1990. And these buckets are log scale. So this peak here is about 2 to 4 milliseconds. And then we have over here the outliers at like tens of seconds for like a typical desktop workload with someone like using text editors and so on. So our observation is that we have applications which do I/O and CPU alternating. So we have these millisecond CPU bursts and milliseconds of I/O. And that's what we're scheduling, is these short CPU bursts. So those, when I showed you it has this many units of time, what I'm actually showing you is that's our CPU burst time. So it's drawn from these distributions. So it's typically very short. And that's going to inform what we want our time quantum to be like, because you know, this is what we have to worry about the turnaround time of. So we're going to be looking at, you know, our problem from the perspective of how good are we doing scheduling what's on the write-a-q, which are these CPU bursts. So that's what we're looking at as far as those metrics. All right, I did duplication. Okay. So let's go back with that in mind, you know, think about how our performance with first come, first served, and something which happened there. So we saw with first come, first served that order mattered. And we're going to be really concerned about optimizing mean turnaround time. So we said round robin, we had this parameter, doesn't help us optimize turnaround time. Like, we set it lower, and who knows what happens to turnaround time. We set it higher, who knows what happens to the turnaround time. So we want to optimize turnaround time, and the reason we're going to want to do that is if we think about those CPU bursts, the things which have those, the turnaround time is how long from when I press a key to when I get output is it going to take. And we know that we're going to have a variety of amount of computations things need to do, because that's empirically what happened, and we want to do good under that assumption. So we don't have, like, scheduling things fairly isn't going to optimize turnaround time, because we have some things which take a lot longer than others. So we're going to look at what happened with first come, first served. And I gave you these examples where the order in which things came in had this huge effect. And in fact, there's a property of these orders that, oh, and I wrote the wrong label on this one. So this should be C, BA. So that one of these orders is going to be fastest, and one of these orders is going to be slowest. And in fact, there's a rule here that the order which is slowest, in terms of highest turnaround time, the order which has the highest mean turnaround time, is the order in which we do the longest thing first, and the order which is fastest is the order where we do the shortest thing first. So the CBA order has the shortest turnaround time. And one way of thinking about this intuitively is that we want to let things start waiting for their next I/O as soon as possible. So the fastest way we can have something start waiting for I/O is running C, and running C until it's done. So that's the fastest way of having C start waiting for I/O, and that's the fastest way of having anything start waiting for I/O. And after we finish C, the fastest way of having something start waiting for, you know, the next I/O, the next key press, is to run B until it's done. So we run in order from shortest to longest, and that's going to give us the lowest mean turnaround time. And if we do the opposite of that, well, now C is going to have to wait the longest possible amount of time to do it, and we're making the worst possible turnaround time. And a way of thinking about this is it's a race to go to sleep. We want to have our programs go to sleep, start waiting as soon as possible. Okay, so questions on this idea here? CPU burst, so this is the CPU computation we need to do after we get some input until we can wait for the next input. And that's our unit of scheduling, is that we're scheduling these bursts of CPU. And that's what we're going to evaluate. Even we're not going to look at the higher level of like the overall program has all multiple things it needs to do. We're just going to look at this single point in time where we have a bunch of programs that need to do a bunch of stuff before they wait for I/O again. And that's the scheduling problem we're going to be concerned with right now. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have this notion, and I'm going to talk about a different scheduling goal and a policy that meets that goal that will initially seem unrelated, but we'll go back to this and make them related. So let's say I want to make a decision that, you know, I'm not going to look at turnaround time or fairness. Instead, I'm going to make a policy decision that some things are more important than other things. So like my shell is more important than that giant simulation I'm running on my system. My shell should always run before we spend any time on that simulation. I want my shell to be fast. Or maybe we have a shared machine and the faculty programs, they should run first before any of the student programs. The faculty need the best service possible. Doesn't matter what the students get. You know, so our scheduling algorithm based on this policy is pretty simple, that if we have a list of ready programs, we're going to look at the ones which are shells or the ones which are faculty programs. We're going to run those before we run anything else. So a schedule which algorithm which does this is often known as priority scheduling. So one way of organizing this is we can have a bunch of queues. So we split up our ready queue into a set of queues, one for each possible priority level. In this case, I'm saying priority 15 is the most important. And so what I'm going to do when I need to run a new program is rather than take the next thing on the list like round robin, I'm going to go through these queues. I'm going to start with the most important one. I'm going to take a process from there if I can. And if I can't, I'm going to go down to the next one until I find something that I can run. And here I've shown the possibility that maybe we have some programs with equal priority, and we have to decide how to run them. One thing you might imagine is that we do the same. We do round robin if we have multiple programs of the same priority. So in this example, we'd run A and B alternating for some amount of time until A and B weren't runnable. About this. So far it looks like, yeah, you.
No. Yeah, just a quick question. What decides the priority?
So the question is, what decides the priority? So this is based on a policy, so the system administrator is going to have to configure that. Yeah?
Wouldn't it be faster to instead do round robin to do a first come first serve?
So the question is, wouldn't it be faster to do round robin instead of first come first serve? So.
Wouldn't it be better to do first come first serve instead of round robin?
So you said, wouldn't first come first serve be better than round robin? So the scheduling goal I have here doesn't specify anything about what the trade-offs are between things at the same importance. So I haven't given you enough information to know whether my goals are such that first come first serve would be better or round robin, as long as we're talking about what we do about process A and B here, which have the same importance. So we don't know. And we could imagine either is true. Because like what you can think of is that question is like, which faculty, how do I favor different faculty programs? And we might say we want to be fair between all of them, or maybe we don't. That's a separate decision. It's a good question. Yeah, because, yeah, I didn't specify enough to do that. Okay, so there's another detail of this. So far it looks like this is round robin, but instead of choosing the next thing to run as the next thing on the list, we take the highest importance thing, the highest priority thing to run. There's another detail, which is that we want to do preemption, that if a higher priority program comes along and becomes runnable, we don't want to wait until the current program's time quantum expires. Part of this importance thing is we should run it right away. That when I press a key for my faculty program, it should start running and stop whatever else is happening. There's no other faculty programs. So typically, when we do the scheduling, it's going to also be preemptive. We're going to stop whatever's running if something higher priority comes along. So this is unlike round robin, where we only stop programs if they wait for too long. Here, we're going to stop programs if anything more important's available to run. So, priority scheduling. So let's say I have process A at highest priority, and it does a pattern. So it's going to run indefinitely. It does I/O for 1 unit of time, like reading from a disk, then does CPU for 10 units of time, then does I/O for 1 unit of time, CPU for 10 units of time, and so on. And I have process Z at the lowest possible priority, which just needs to do a big computation, which takes 400 units of time. So how long should process C take to complete? And you can check your answers with your neighbor with priority scheduling. Okay, who wants more time? Okay, someone have a possible answer they'd like to volunteer? Okay, back there.
Yeah, he thinks it's 44,000.
So 44,000, where does that come from?
I think it's like process A starts and there's 10 CPU units and then does a context switch for I/O, which lets process C do exactly 1 unit, and then they have to do that same thing 4,000 times to finish process C.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So we have this alternating 10 units of A, then A does I/O, so we can now the CPU is free for 1 unit of time to run Z, and that's how we get 1 unit left. And we might have a little, this might be slightly off for startup and shutdown, startup effects, like we started a little late or something. But basically, it's around 44,000 units of time. So runs like, gets about 1/11th of the CPU. So questions on how you figure this out? So it might be a little less than 44K because A might Z finishes at some point, but depends where we are in A when Z starts. Okay. So here's an alternate example. So figure this one out. So I'll give you a minute, check with your neighbor. Just have a second program at the second highest priority.
Doesn't say that A and B go up to any better than
It says repeat forever. Who wants more time? Okay, someone want to volunteer an answer? No, any? Okay, there. So you say Z will never complete, and that's what I believe is correct. So what happens here is that we have a similar schedule that A runs for 10 units of time, because it's highest priority. So it runs 10 units, that's not clearly an A. And then we run B for 1 unit of time. And then we run A for 10 units of time again, and so on. Now, you might say, well, eventually B is going to do IO. That's true. So B gets to do, eventually, like after a bunch of this, we have B runs for 1 unit of time, and then does its IO while A is running. And it finishes I.O. by the time A is ready to do its next I.O., so Z never gets a chance to run ever. Like, literally never runs. Yeah?
Theoretically speaking, if B was running its I.O. during that period, and then A was running its I.O. during that period, could Z not run its CPU for one cycle while B was running its I.O.?
So the question is, if A and B were doing their I.O. at the same time, then yes, Z would have a chance to run. I don't believe that's, if things are exactly as specified, I think that can't happen, because the one unit A does to do the I.O. is exactly where B will run some computation. And it will finish up that computation just in time to make sure the I.O. overlaps with A running. But if the times were slightly different, yes, Z would get a slow little chance to run. Like if A's I.O. takes, you know, so if A's I.O. like took 0.9 units of time, we might have that, something like that happening. Yeah?
So if your second highest priority is running, what actually signals that like yield to go back to the higher priority?
So the question is, when implementing this, how do we make sure that in the case where B was running, when A becomes runnable, that we start running A, the higher priority thing? And the answer is that when A became runnable because some sort of exception happened, because some I.O. operation completes. So the handler for that exception, as part of its handler, is going to switch to process A in an implementation of the schedule. So we don't see that in XV6, because this is not XV6's scheduler. But in a system that does this type of scheduling, as part of handling the I.O. operation finishing, we're going to switch to a program if it has a high enough priority. Okay, question? So this phenomenon is known as starvation. And this explains why I talked about fairness as a metric. And this is why people really want to have a fairness metric, because it's really annoying when you come up with your clever scheduler and suddenly this can happen. Most people say, I don't want my system to allow something like process C to happen, where it never actually runs. And that's why you might have a fairness metric. So questions on priority scheduling? So when I started talking about priority scheduling, I promised I'd connect it back to our first come, first served. And we're going to connect it back to minimizing turnaround time. And recall that in the first come, first served, the best order was the shortest CPU burst first, the thing which wanted to use the least CPU until it needed to do the next its next I/O operation. So this is known as shortest job first. And it's same as priority, where the priority is determined by how long is the CPU burst. And for now, we're going to look at this without preemption. So we're just going to say, we're not going to do the thing where we start running the higher priority thing immediately. We're just going to do, we're just only going to wait until something finishes. But the thing we'll run next is going to be based on what has the shortest CPU burst. So we're just going to set our priorities that way. Okay. So one question, if you're thinking about like how you implement this scheme, one question you might have is, well, I know how to implement, like roughly how you'd implement a priority scheduler, is you have like different queues at each priority. How do I figure out whether a program goes at priority 15 or 14, which I need to do by looking at how long its CPU burst is? This isn't like, is it run by faculty or student, which there might be an easy way of figuring out. Here, like, how do we figure out, like, is this program going to need a long time on the CPU? Like, you know, how do I tell if a thread works that way? So we're going to punt on this. We're going to deal with this later, sort of. There's not a real solution, but there's a good enough solution that we'll talk about. But it is an actual problem, so what I'm talking about, the schedule I'm talking about, like, you can't actually do, because we don't actually know how long something will take. Okay, so here's an example of a bunch of programs. And similar to before, we have this alternating CPU and I/O. I'm going to talk about what shortest job first looks like. So what we're going to do is, let's say there's already at the beginning of time, or a time, and we're going to run the shortest burst, and then the next shortest, and so on. So this is the schedule we get. The arrows represent waiting for I/O and how long the I/O waits are. So you can see what we're doing here with the shortest job first schedule is whenever we need to make a decision, we run the shortest thing. So initially, everything's runnable, but B has the shortest amount of CPU it wants to use until it's ready to wait for I/O. So we run B first, then C has the shortest amount, then only A is runnable, so we run A. When A finishes, it turns out that C is runnable again, and it's the shortest, so we run that. And then B gets to run, C gets to run, and then we get to here. And you might notice that something bad happened here, that we wanted to achieve this effect of running the thing that was ready first, but we had some bad luck. That we still had this convoy effect of waiting behind something slow because of when I/O's finished. And that what really happened, because we weren't doing preemption, because I was waiting, not said I would not do preemption for now, a consequence of that decision was that I was effectively ordering things based on when their I/O's completed, and when we only had one thing waiting at a time, that didn't actually help us. Like, it made sure that here we ran C, B first, but it didn't mean that we, but we really wanted to start running B earlier to lower our turnaround time. We had all this extra time that B was waiting, which it probably shouldn't have been. So we went to add preemption. And you might think, okay, so you just add preemption, you have the same priorities, your priorities are the CPU bursts, and you just, when a new job arrives, if it's shorter than the thing that's running now, you schedule it right away. So our priority is the, you know, so in this, but I told you our priority equals the length of the CPU burst. So the amount of CPU it wants to use. And if you do that naively, you won't quite get the right solution. So there's a little nit to make this actually work correctly. And the problem is, let's think of a job that's almost done running. If the job is almost done running, and something else finishes in the middle, what we should do is let the thing that's almost done finish. So we don't actually have the static priority based on how long your CPU burst is. As you get closer and closer to being able to do your next I/O, we want to run you more and more. And we don't want to wait. If you only have one unit of time left before you need to do an I/O, we want to let you run that one unit of time, even if something else comes along that has a CPU burst length of 2 versus yours of 10. Because we don't care. You know, we've already paid for the 9 units of CPU before that. We just want to get things done as soon as possible with what the status of things right now are. So what we're going to do is our priority is going to change. And it's going to be the remaining time. So at any point in time to decide what to run, we're going to order by this importance metric, which is how much time do you have left before you do I/O. And as you run, this changes. So if something else becomes ready while you're running, we're not going to look at how long did you need in total to get to your next I/O operation. We're going to look at how long do you have left right now. We're going to ignore the past. Okay, prioritized by what's left and not the total. So let's do that here. So this is called shortest remaining time first. So what this does here is now we have a similar idea. We do C first. Sorry, we do B first because it has the shortest CPU burst. Then we do C because it's now the shortest after B finishes. Then we do A. But in the middle of A, B finishes. It's I/O. And B needs less time to start waiting for I/O again than A does right now. Because you can see A has a little more work to do than B does. So we run B first, and then we finish running A. And after that, we run C. So C came in here. C had a shorter CPU burst, but at this point in time, I think here, we don't put C in right away because A only has a little bit of work left to do. We want to let A finish because that's going to lower our turnaround time more than starting C earlier. And one way of thinking about that is that if we're going to add the time it would take C to run to A's turnaround time if we ran C first, versus adding one unit of time, this little sliver, to C's turnaround time. So it's better to add that little sliver to C's turnaround time. Yes?
Is that blank space just like a period where nothing is running?
The question is, this blank space a period where nothing is running? Yes. Where everyone is waiting to do I/O. And versus earlier here, B preempts A because B had less stuff left to do than A did. Okay. So questions about how this works? You look, yeah.
I feel like I just finished the diagram, but shouldn't program A be running there? It looks like it has an X block, but it has
a here? A started, so. Oh, here? So A starts, A and C finish their I/O here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They're overlapping arrows. Maybe they should be different colors or something. Okay. Other questions? So this is known as I said, shortest remaining time first. And it turns out, I'm not going to show you the proof, but the shortest job first, so that what is the minimum response waiting turnaround time, if you disallow preemption and disallow deliberately leaving the CPU idle when something is runnable. So it's provably the best thing you can do if you don't have preemption and you don't want to just leave the CPU idle for a while for no reason when something could run. And shortest remaining time first minimizes this turnaround time, response time, waiting time if you ignore context switch costs overall. It's like the best you can possibly do, ignoring context switches. So context switches could change the answer here. And for no preemption, I'm saying you could leave the CPU idle deliberately because the idea would be you wait for something short to come in before you start running something long. This is assuming you don't do that. You just run something if it's ready. Okay, so questions on these? Okay. Yeah. So SJF doesn't, but you can do. But if you don't want to do preemption, you can do better for turnaround time than SJF by saying, "Oh, I have one thing I can run, but it needs to run for a really long time. So instead, I'm going to wait for something short to come in before running that long thing." This is assuming you don't do that sort of trick. So a note on names. So I'm going to always use SRTF, shortest remaining time first, to mean the preemptive algorithm, and SJF to mean the non-preemptive algorithm, where, non-preemptive algorithm. Some books use different names. Some books will use SJF to refer to both, depending on whether it's, they'll say preemptive SJF or non-preemptive. I'm going to try to use this distinction, but just to warn you that you might see different terms. So we have these nice scheduling algorithms for optimizing this turnaround time. And I told you that this sort of corresponds to, like, when I press keys, how fast do I get responses on average? Like, that seems to be what it corresponds to. It's a great thing to optimize. So we have the perfect algorithm. The problem is we need to know how long things take to run. It seems like we don't actually know that. So what can we do about that? Well, one possibility you might come up with is you might say, let's ask. Let's have the programs tell us how long they take to run. And some systems do that. So this is common in batch scheduling systems. And sometimes the programmers actually even give you correct answers, or mostly correct answers. But this isn't quite a viable approach. So we're going to talk about a way of approximating SJF with or shortest remaining time first with priorities that actually figures out, gets an estimate of this job time. And our goal in doing this is to get things at the right priority level. So we're going to say that things at priority 3 are the things which have the short CPU burst of 0 to 1 seconds versus 1 to 10 versus 10 to 20 and 20 or more. And we're going to use a nice little assumption to figure it out. So we're going to have this bucket applies the CPU burst length. So you want to order things by that. And you might say, maybe we can look at some information about the process. We think about, this is our struct proc. Is anything there helpful? Not really, turns out. So we're going to use heuristics to figure it out. And the key heuristic we're going to use, this is just a heuristic, it's a guess. It's going to not always be right. But our guess is going to be how much time you need to do your CPU burst, how much time you need to do your next I.O. now, is the same as it's going to be later. So we're just going to look at history, and that's how we're going to do this, and that's what we'll talk about next time.